I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama was in New Orleans yesterday to mark the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina that devastated that city and many parts of the Gulf Coast. He said it was a natural disaster that became a man-made disaster, a failure of government to look out for its citizens. Who can forget those pictures of desperate people at the Superdome and residents on roofs asking to be rescued? A lot of money has been invested in New Orleans in the last decade, but polls show that white residents have a much more positive view of the recovery than black residents. Our guest is Jarvis DeBerry. He's editorial writer and columnist for NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. That's the newspaper that did such important coverage of the storm and its aftermath. And Jarvis DeBerry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you joining us as well. I know you've been very busy talking about this anniversary. If you were to take me to the real New Orleans today, where would we go?
That's a question that's almost impossible to answer because there are so many different New Orleanses that, and all of them count as real, I think. So I mean, that's the first thing that I would say. Right now, I happen to be sitting in the Garden District in New Orleans, which was relatively unscathed by the storm. I say relatively because everybody got some type of damage. I would imagine if only the wind and ripping the roof off or shingles off of their house. But if you go into other parts of the city, you see homes that have either been abandoned or lots that are completely empty and overgrown with weeds. Other people are back and have probably resumed their everyday lives, but there are people still in other parts of the country who still haven't been able to get back. So it really depends. The best way that I know how to put it, if you were relatively okay before Hurricane Katrina, then it's more likely that you are now. If you were well-insured, if you were well-employed, if you had a nice, healthy savings account, if you had all of those amenities that we expect from people who are doing relatively well. If you were living on the razor's edge, if you were living on the margins before 2005, it's a lot less likely that you are back in New Orleans and comfortable in New Orleans.
So how is it a very different city today, or a city that feels like New Orleans of 10 years ago, but with some, you know, subtle and slight different variations?
A little bit of both. I was feeling a wave of nostalgia yesterday, so I went back to the neighborhood where I lived before the storm. It was Gentilly. And it was a neighborhood, I would guess, of people of modest means. You know, I work for the newspaper across the street. There was a man who worked security for Tulane University, a couple of houses down. There was another man who had a lawn care building. None of us were, you know, doing excessively well, but just a kind of modest living, good working class, maybe upwardly mobile, I would say, neighborhood. But I went there last night, and I was actually surprised to hear what housing prices are going for now. I bought my house there for $147,000 in January 2004. And I was told last night that there was a house on the market just recently for $410,000.
Wow.
And it had actually sold for $395,000. And so that just floored me, that kind of neighborhood where I live, that is the type of asking price that you're getting from people now, and that people are paying that much money. And this is not, you would expect a premium on the houses in neighborhoods that didn't flood, but this is a neighborhood that flooded heavily. And if somebody can ask $410,000 and get $395 in a neighborhood that was heavily flooded, then that gives you an indication of just what real estate prices are doing all across the city. And that makes it really difficult for people who are, you know, have a starting salary and are looking to move into New Orleans to find a place to live.
Where do you live now? As you said, you lived in Gentilly, and as I was reading some of your articles, sounds like you lost your house. So where do you live now,
James? I did. I lost that house. I say lost. It was heavily but it was damaged. And I had a decision. I could try to put my energy in there and to rebuild it, or I could sell it to the state. There was a road home program, a government program that allowed people to sell their houses to the state. And so I did that because I didn't want the feeling of being on a frontier. I didn't want to be the only house on the block or the only house in the neighborhood. And when I was talking to someone last night who did move onto the street, she moved there in 2009. And she said when she moved there in 2009, it felt like a frontier. Mm-hmm. So I that kind of confirmed my decision to leave at that point. Right now I live further into the city in a neighborhood called Fontainebleau, which is not too far. It's within walking distance of Tulane and Loyola. We actually bought it. My wife and I bought it as a foreclosed property. So the price was a little better than we could have expected on, you know, the other market. But that being said, the housing prices around us have completely exploded. And we've talked about selling, but the question is, okay, if we sold, where could we possibly buy in a city? Yeah. It's becoming difficult to find something that people can afford.
I quoted, and there have been a number of studies or polls or surveys looking at how residents in New Orleans feel about their city, and it looks like there is a racial divide. Is that true, and has that always been part of New Orleans' reality?
You know, I happened to cross paths this week with both Senator Mary Landrieu, who was did not win re-election this past year, and her brother Mitch Landrieu, who is the mayor of New Orleans, and both of them made a similar point that all across the country, and probably every city you go to, I would imagine, it's the same in Philadelphia, that black residents and white residents have a different experience and a different reality. And that if you polled black Chicagoans and white Chicagoans, you would probably get a different idea of what life is like and what people say that their lives are like. And so that it should be expected to be similar, if not the same, in New Orleans. I can understand that in theory. But my response to that is that so many people have boasted of New Orleans to become some type of laboratory, that we are going to lead the way in rethinking schools, rethinking whatever the case may be. And if we can boast about being innovative in all of those other ways, then we should also be thinking a lot more seriously about being innovative, about narrowing those racial disparities that persist everywhere in America. So, yeah, I think it is true that black people and white people have had a vastly different experience. And there are multiple reasons for that. I can't go into all of them. But among them is this: the road home program, which I mentioned was supposed to help homeowners get back on their feet, had a fundamental problem in that the money you got to repair your home was based on the value of your home and not the cost to rebuild your home. And so a person who lives in a black neighborhood could have an identical home to a person who lives in a white neighborhood. But because the person who lives in a white neighborhood, that house is considered more valuable, that person gets more money according to the formula. And so because that formula was created that way, you have black neighborhoods and black homeowners who did not necessarily get the same amount of money for repair, even if they had had identical damage to an identical house that a white homeowner would have had. On top of that, you had a mass layoff and mass firing of teachers who were employed by Orleans Parish School Board. And teachers in so many communities are kind of the backbone of the middle class, at least for the African-American community. And so when you combine black people generally getting less money to repair their houses and kind of wiping the slate of teachers who were in the city, then you can imagine how that might give you a very, very different experience sure. if you're black or if you're white.
Sure. And a couple of more minutes, and I have a couple more questions for you, Jarvis. I wonder about the news coverage 10 years ago. You have written about New Orleans' multiple personalities. That's a quote from something that you wrote. But I wonder how much outsiders, especially coming to a place like New Orleans, trying to cover Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath, how much they truly understood the city that they were covering.
It's doubtful that they did. I've lived in New Orleans since 1997. I've been here for 18 years. And I can tell you that I still struggle to understand the city, really. And there are people who say I don't understand it at all. and so it is really, really difficult to get a grasp. And it humbled me as a journalist, I have to say, looking at some of the coverage that came out of here, because it made me think, how well would I perform if I went to Salt Lake City and tried to report there on some type of tragedy, if I went to Philadelphia, or if I went to Los Angeles? You know, I don't know the layout of the land the way that I would know places that are more familiar to me. And so New Orleans kind of resists easy characterization, and I think that is the danger that many people make here. And it is impossible for me, in my mind at least, to write an anecdotal story that applies to everybody. You know, I guess that's true for all journalists, and it's something that all journalists have to remember. But you can find somebody doing well. It doesn't mean that everybody is doing well. You can find somebody struggling. It doesn't mean that everybody is struggling. And so my disappointment with journalists was, from 2005, was number one, they were reporting things that were not verified. And number two, there was some type, there were some shortcuts that were made where people kind of made some quick assumptions about New Orleans. And New Orleans resists that.
And Jarvis, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, do people trust the levees? I know a lot of money invested in rebuilding or certainly redesigning the levees. Is there confidence that if another Hurricane Katrina were to come to New Orleans, the city would be okay?
What happened in 2005 was that the flood walls and the levees fell apart. And that's an important thing for people to remember. It immediately we thought that the levees just got overtopped, and that's why everything bad happened. But the 17th Street Canal, one of the biggest in the city, the biggest drainage canal in the city, did not get overtopped, and yet it fell apart.
Right.
And so overtopping we can handle. Even if it's a big storm, even if we get flooding on the streets, we can handle that. What we don't want is a system that just falls completely apart. And I think that we have a system that we pray is tough enough not to just fall to pieces like it did last time.
Well, Jarvis DeBerry, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. He's editorial writer, columnist for NOLA.com, The Times, Picayune. I've loved several visits to your city, Jarvis. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
No problem. You're very welcome. We'll be talking about the children of Katrina after this very short break. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. One of the most heartbreaking stories about Hurricane Katrina's devastation was its impact on children who lost their homes and, in some cases, members of their family. Many lived in shelters and temporary housing with no schools to attend. Our guest, Alice Fothergill, interviewed children, their parents, and teachers who lived through the storm. She's associate professor of sociology at the University of Vermont and wrote a book with Lori Peek titled The Children of Katrina, and she joins us on Radio Times. Alice Fothergill, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. We are marking the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and in this portion, talking about its impact on children. To you, Alice, for the children who were traumatized by Katrina, was it the storm itself or the devastation after the storm that has been so difficult for them?
Well, that's a really good question, and I would have to say it's both. The storm itself, especially for all of those thousands of children who were literally left behind in the city of New Orleans, That was an incredibly traumatizing event, and those negative outcomes, you know, play out for years and years in all sorts of ways, perhaps in different ways depending on the age of the child at the time of the storm. But all of the children of New Orleans were displaced,
yeah.
And so they've all had a hard road this last, you know, decade. And we found that all kids immediately after the storm had a decline because of the incredible disruption and the separation from family and friends and the uncertainty about the safety of their loved ones. And but some children were able to regain their footing, but others haven't been able to.
And I do want to talk about, I guess, the difference between those children. But I'm also thinking about those, you know, we're revisiting those pictures from Katrina.
Right.
Those children at the Superdome with their parents, you know,
right.
Desperate for food and water and someone to rescue them. People on rooftops, you know, waving banners or, you know, putting up signs on the roof saying, save us, rescue us. And I'm trying to imagine children who look to the adults in their lives to provide some kind of support and some kind of explanation, how difficult that must have been for the kids.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, absolutely traumatizing. There is no doubt about it, and it plays out in all sorts of ways. Younger children became very clingy, had nightmares, had behavior issues. Older children lost interest in school or started drinking or doing other things that were sort of higher risk. And for some, it's a difficult thing to tease out because a lot of children have what we call cumulative vulnerability. So the storm was an intense crisis in their lives, but they'd also, there are numerous children who had already been going through very difficult times. For example, we had children in our study who had either been victims of violence or had witnessed terrible acts of violence prior to the disaster. So sometimes this was adding up. And then maybe add to that scenario that they're finally rescued, they're taken to a shelter, they move around, they start different schools, they have new caregivers, new teachers, and then maybe they end up in a school where the kids there don't want kids from New Orleans. They've heard all these terrible things, and all of a sudden they're being bullied terribly. And that was quite common for a lot of kids. They found that they were not welcome in their new schools. So if you put all of those things together, you can see why we call that cumulative vulnerability. They really have a lot of things they're dealing with.
And under those circumstances, what do children need from the adults in their lives?
Well, they needed a lot, and some children were able to get it and some weren't. They needed to know that their families were safe, and they needed routine and predictability. Sometimes they needed professional help. They needed counselors, social workers, therapists. We visited some schools in New Orleans when people started to return, and we, over a course of many years, we would visit these schools, and we were very surprised by the number of schools that didn't have a social worker or a counselor to help the children, and that seemed like at the very least, children needed that. We did hear lots of great stories from people who, children who went to shelters around Louisiana or in Texas, and the host communities doing all sorts of wonderful things and, you know, doing as much as they could. And we did go to many shelters where the host communities had many volunteers there to help with recreation or homework or child care. So there were lots of efforts, but I have to say kids needed probably more than they got.
You and your co-author interviewed children ages, what, about 3 to,
teen, to 18.
3
yeah,
to 18.
The full scope, yeah.
And let's say you're talking to a 6-year-old who's just, you know, dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. How do you talk to a young person like that? What did you want to know from a child, let's say, that age?
Right. Well, so Lori and I found that the spending time with younger children required a sort of different methods, different approach. And we often would do art with them or play with Play-Doh or let them guide the conversation or do a lot of observation. And sometimes it required multiple visits, so they got used to us, and they got comfortable with us, and they would talk to us. And sometimes they would remember things about the storm, sometimes they wouldn't, but they could definitely talk to us about living in their FEMA trailer. What did they think of this new place they lived, and were they making friends, and how were things playing out, and did they miss New Orleans? And a lot of kids talked to us about wanting to go back. There was this sense of not being rooted where they were. So the young ones, definitely we had to sort of take a different approach. And we found with a lot of the children, even the older children also, that time, it really helped that we studied them for so many years so that they grew comfortable. And it was interesting to see how they didn't always tell their parents everything. So sometimes they could see that their parents were distressed and maybe didn't tell them about all of their fears or anxieties because they wanted to protect them a little bit.
And protect them because they, you know, they care about their parents. But,
right.
I mean, that's a very adult thing for a child to do.
Right. Absolutely. We thought the same thing. So they were definitely tuned in to what was going on around them, and they were soaking it in, absolutely.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Alice Fothergill, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We are remembering, marking the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. I don't need to describe to you its impact. I think we all know that. And Alice and her co-author, Lori Peek, wrote a book called Children of Katrina, interviewed a number of children ages, 3 to 18. And again, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Alice, for the children that you got to know over this period of time, was there a difference for those children that seem to be able to get over Hurricane Katrina and those that are still traumatized by what happened? What are the differences there? Are there differences?
Right. Well, so we found these three patterns of post-disaster trajectory. So the children who declined significantly over the last decade and children who found their footing, we call finding equilibrium. And then these children who fluctuated for years, up and down over the course of the study. And I would have to say that the main thing is the issue about this pre-disaster vulnerability and how much they were at risk before, so how many of the resources their family had. So really it was much more about structural disadvantage over individual characteristics. So a child, we could see, had many of the characteristics that you would think of when you think of a resilient child, everything about their personality and their outlook and the effort they put in and the amount that, you know, their coping strategies. And yet they might end up declining because they've got so many things working against them. So a child, for example, who had been in poverty beforehand, who did witness awful things during the storm and then perhaps had a life-threatening evacuation, bounced around from school to school, and then that family wants to return. And actually, your previous guest made the important point about this issue of affordable housing. So many of the people in our study had lived in the New Orleans housing projects, these low-income housing complexes, that some received moderate damage and some weren't damaged at all, and the federal government decided to tear them down. So they were taken out, and I believe that's over 4,000 units of housing for low-income residents gone. So the families in our study, they couldn't return. There was the housing market was so difficult, the rental units were gone, and what has been found in all disasters in the U.S. is that it's much more difficult for renters than homeowners to get back on their feet. There are more assistance programs for owners than renters. So these kinds of things are working against these families' recovery, and children are caught in that.
You wrote about a number of children, including a girl named Sierra, describing the sound of Katrina for her at age 11 were people screaming. How is Sierra doing today?
Well, she's doing well. she is, she did not return to New Orleans. She still lives with her mother, a single mother. And Sierra is, you know, she is an amazing young woman now. And she, but I think it did, she struggled. And even though she did find her footing, she struggled with some depression. She had some amazing help along the way with teachers in her new school. Her mother worked tirelessly as her, you know, as her advocate. And she met people, some adults in the shelter, who we see as connecting her to important institutional resources. So she really got a lot of assistance. They were able to get a Habitat for Humanity home, which is a huge, just turned things around for them. Wow. And she was able to make new friends. But when the time came, when she had always planned to leave home and go to college, when the time came to do that, she did decide against it. And it is hard to know, it's hard to know why she changed her path. And I do think that it is some of the things that she's gone through, and maybe her need to maybe be with her mother or not have another big change. So I think it, you know, the disaster will play out in different ways for the children as they become young adults and the decisions that they make.
President Obama was in New Orleans yesterday in the Ninth Ward talking about the city's recovery, and he called out a couple of young men who had been, as sounds like they had been children while this was all going on, while Katrina hit, and of course in the aftermath. But he acknowledged the fact that these young men were doing things to rebuild the city. And I wonder, for children themselves, how important is it for them to do things, to be proactive in the face of some kind of disaster?
Right. That's a great question. So that's one of our major findings, is that children have these tremendous capacities, and they should be they contribute in incredible ways to before the storm preparedness, during the storm. We heard all sorts of stories about the ways in which they helped others, even rescued people or comforted others. And in the recovery period, we saw numerous times where children were able to participate in the recovery of others in ways that were profound, and they helped take care of younger children, or they actually helped adults quite a bit. And I think that's something that disaster scholarship has found for a long time, is that children need to be part of this community, this collective, and they need to also feel a little bit of control over the recovery and contribute to that. And by doing that, they also are helping their own recovery. So it's often called a community of sufferers, or a community of altruism, where people want to contribute, and children and youth also want to be part of that. They want to be doing those things. And also, children found ways to help themselves. We heard stories from young children who came up with interesting coping strategies, and one of them was a game. Evacuation had been so stressful, and one of the ways they were processing it was they played the evacuation game. And they would run around their house with a bag and throw random items from each room in it, rushing frantically, and that was their game of evacuation. And so they amazed us in their ways they were able to find ways to cope, find ways to help each other. You know, even, you know, those children who had lemonade stands and gave the proceeds to some community recovery effort, those are all very meaningful.
As you said, the youngest children that you worked with were 3 years old. So now, 10 years later, they're 13 years old. Is it traumatizing for teenagers or children to mark an anniversary, as we are marking the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina? Or is there something about remembering and ritual that can be healing for kids?
Right. That's a good question. It's really both of those things. Anniversaries are really tricky, and I've heard a lot of different things from the children and families in the last couple weeks. They are important, and the rituals are important, but some people, it's very traumatizing. Those images that we're all seeing again, those can be very difficult to see. So some people wish this anniversary was, you know, we weren't talking about it because it's painful. And other people say this is important. We need to see how far we've come. Let's focus on where we're going next. But I think it's a really, really good opportunity for all of us outside of New Orleans to say, okay, so what have we done for children since then? So it's been 10 years. Would we be in the same spot? Would children be at risk like this? And so shortly after Katrina, President Bush and Congress created a National Commission on Children and Disasters, which was fabulous. And the committee met and came up with a report and all sorts of great recommendations to keep children safe. But we haven't met most of those goals. So almost 80% haven't been filled. So we are moving in the right direction. So the anniversary gives us this opportunity to say, okay, we've only done 20% of the things we said we'd do to keep children safe in this country. So let's finish those. This is our time to say, okay, we took a really good step forward, but let's finish those recommendations.
And Alice, we're almost out of time here. Would one of those recommendations include making sure that schools have counselors? You mentioned for a number of the kids, there weren't counselors.
Yeah, so schools, all sorts of things in terms of preparedness and comprehensive evacuation plans and having child care centers prepared and having paying attention to physical and mental health. Yes, all sorts of things are on those lists. So it is a lot, but if we could accomplish those things, it would really help.
Well, Alice Fothergill, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Vermont is co-author with Laurie Peake, a book titled Children of Katrina. After this very short break, our guest is Nick Spitzer, host of American Roots, which you can hear here on WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Al Johnson Jr. sang his song Lower Ninth Ward Blues at a ceremony earlier this month. It was at a site marking where the flood wall collapsed during Hurricane Katrina, destroying much of New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward. Let's give a listen.
I don't know what to do, 'cause I'm feeling a blue. I'm calling it, oh, 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 I'm naming it, Lower Ninth Ward Blues. I'm thankful to God above, through it all, shows so much love. I'm calling it, naming it,
naming it,
Lower Ninth Ward
Blues.
Al Johnson Jr. released that song in 2007 and is one of the many musicians who call New Orleans home. President Obama described the city as a gateway to America's soul at a ceremony yesterday marking the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. We spoke to Nick Spitzer, producer and host of APM's American Roots, about his city a decade ago, and he joins us once again. Nick is a folklorist. He specializes in the music and culture of the Gulf region. You can hear his show at 6 p.m. Sundays here at WHYY. And Nick Spitzer, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, it's good to be back.
Good to have you back.
I have to say, when I hear Al Johnson, you know, it reminds me of why over the years New Orleans and Philadelphia have been known as sister cities. That's soulful swamp pop R&B that could fit into Philly, I think, too.
Well, we were kind of rocking our heads here listening to him sing. How are you? I don't know. Are you marking the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina? What are you doing?
I'm mostly talking to people around the world about what's been going on. I haven't gotten out with a shovel or a paintbrush on this go-round. I've done that before and hung a little sheetrock and stripped a little sheetrock. But I've been keeping our operation going. In fact, our show this week on HYY sort of looks back over the 10 years with music and commentary. So we're doing our thing as part of the media and culture part of what New Orleans is for the nation.
As I mentioned, President Obama described New Orleans as a gateway to America's soul. And sort of broadly speaking, Nick, how has music recovered, can I put it that way, in New Orleans? Uh-huh.
Well, I think there's been a profound recovery here and a new creation here. Not everything is recovered as we'd like. And, you know, we have some of the same problems Philadelphia has in terms of a tax base and urban violence and drugs and all kinds of the urban issues that all cities face. But we have something very special that we always have shared, which is culture. Not to say there's not great culture in Philly and the streets and neighborhoods. I love it. But New Orleans has a kind of a citywide sensibility with the carnival, with New Orleans traditional jazz and the second lines, the food and all those things that kind of unite people. And in the end, it was sort of the intangibles of cultures, particularly music, that brought people back. And so as a result, I think music's as strong here as it's ever been, and actually stronger. There are even bands now that moved to New Orleans as a launching pad, not strictly the music from here originally. So a lot of brass bands, a lot of goodwill, a lot of careers advanced, new music of all kinds. And many, many people are moving here. As you probably know, it's the fastest growing city in the country. Now, we went way down, so we had to grow back. But still, an awful lot of people coming. We call it the brain gain. And music drives the brain because they want to participate.
Well, it's interesting to think of things like levees and buildings and infrastructure. And also then to think of, as you have described, the kind of creativity that drives so much of life in New Orleans.
Well, you know, I think we have to look back at the infrastructure question. We all need infrastructure, and in a way it's part of a human right to live a decent life. But I know of no native New Orleanian that stayed here, returned here, or no person that arrived here because they thought New Orleans had great infrastructure. and you know, in the end, people have come for the freedom of life in the streets and the music and the food and the very strong sense of community. And if anything, our concerns are less about infrastructure sometimes and more about how will the fabric of the old order continue of families and neighborhoods when there's so many arrivistas. And, you know, in America, we tend to love things to death. And so New Orleanians, old school, are a little concerned about that. Infrastructure, yes, there's a lot of areas in the city that are not finished, like New Orleans East and the Ninth Ward that you were speaking of, where, you know, you just had a tidal wave rolling there. That was different. So, you know, we need the infrastructure, but in a way, culture has continued to lead hope and the rebuild and the collaboration in the city.
Interestingly, you described the number of musicians that have moved to New Orleans. Is it, I mean, the fact that real estate prices made that city affordable, though, as I understand, the prices are going up, but they saw, in a sense, a bargain?
Yeah, I mean, I think rentals were fairly inexpensive, particularly after Katrina. They've always been low compared to, New York, San Francisco. Philadelphia has always been a little more reasonable, I realize. But that was part of it. But now rents are getting high and housing prices are rising. And, you know, we lost something like 150,000 housing units. And so they've not all been built back and the population is getting close to back to where it was. So, yeah, there's more pressure on it. But still, the attraction of going somewhere, you know, in the past, maybe they'd go to Austin or Athens if they're into that Americana and Southern rock and country world. And they're actually coming here. We have a band like Hooray for the Riff Raff that's been launched out of New Orleans. And they're not New Orleanians for the most part. But still, I think for us in the city on a regular basis, the enormous number of young brass bands in their teenage years playing on the streets, all the continuing second lines, roughly 50 in the season, from Labor Day to late spring, which are the free jazz parades for Mother's Day and the Saints' Day and all these other things. All that's continuing and growing. And our leaders, our old heroes, Dr. John, Irma Thomas, Alan Toussaint, all have had big career boosts in this last decade and become more visible. So, you know, I think it's a good moment musically to continue to be strong and be different from other cities, because culture really is at the center, culture of this grassroots type. Other places, you'd get the big box amphitheater and the fancy museum. We have a little of that, but we really have this street culture that really grabs people and speaks to community.
I'm looking at something you wrote for the University of Pennsylvania Gazette. This was, it looks like 2006, obviously a year after Katrina. And you talk about the terrible silences, the fact that the city was so, in many ways, so dark and so empty of people.
Yeah, those were grim times.
I bet.
I was writing about, I was in New Orleans about 2 days after the flood, and I had gotten a media pass. I'd been working with Nightline. I was helping them name neighborhoods and streets, and I just ended up, I wasn't at my home. I was sleeping in the media compound. You could hear, what you could hear, unfortunately, were sirens and bullets here and there. But yeah, I mean, by day, there were no birds. There were no children's voices. There were no voices of any kind. You know, you'd step on some broken glass and hear the crack sounded so loud. And yeah, a very musical, exuberant city was just silent. And that plus the smell of death and smoke of old buildings burning and flood water and mildew. I mean, it was very overwhelmingly grim for a very, very long time.
And did you lose a house, or did how were you and your family affected in New Orleans?
Well, I grew up in New England, so I had the stiff upper lip attitude as I'm not leaving.
And then I saw that.
I got to three, and I thought maybe I'll just book a hotel room. Then I thought four. I think I'll book a high hotel room. And when I saw five, I said, "Okay, guys, let's go." And I have two kids, and so we headed out. And you know, our house had the roof hatch blown off, as many did, but. My home is in the sliver by the river, as they call it, the 20% that's not flooded because it's near enough to the high, naturally high levee land of the river. So I didn't have those problems, or a few cracks here and there, a few bent palm trees around, things like that. The massive destruction was in the other 80% of the city, but that includes, you know, the Ninth Ward and the famous Gentilly neighborhoods and Lakeview and really most of the city. So, you know, I checked a lot of people's houses. I broke into people's houses to feed cats. You know, I fended off what I thought were the bad guys here and there. And I went in continually through the fall of 2005, and I saw it slowly but surely begin to get better. The first second line, a restaurant opens, a recording session with Alan Toussaint and Elvis Costello by December.
Oh, wow.
And I moved back with my whole crew for radio and family in mid-January from Lafayette, Louisiana.
And I was hearing about some of the beloved restaurants that have always been part of New Orleans, that they are back, and more restaurants as well. I mean, it is a place for food, need I say, food and music, and I guess architecture as well.
Yeah, the restaurant scene is definitely booming, but I really salute people. It's one of my all-time favorite places I'll recommend to any visitor from your listening area.
Sure.
is Little Dizzy's at Esplanade and Claiborne. And this is the legendary Bacquet family, and Wayne Bacquet runs it. It's one of these classic Creole families that move up and down the social scale, and so he runs the restaurant that's been in the family, a version of it for two generations, and it's kind of Creole soul food. You can get grits and griots for breakfast, or you can get grits and shrimp and po'boys and trout meniere and all this stuff. And then his brother is the editorial director of the Times-Picayune, and another brother is the managing editor of the New York Times. So this is your classic Afro-French descendants of the Jean de Couleur running a restaurant, and he reopened early for the first responders, you know, the police, the firemen, all the emergency workers, Habitat for Humanity. And those people that fed people the food that was home food, they really lifted spirits.
I bet they did. Let me quickly reintroduce you. That very familiar voice, Nick Spitzer, producer, host of APM's American Roots. You can hear his show here at WHYY Sundays at 6. And talking about the city where he lives, New Orleans, talking about the recovery and the important role that culture and music and musicians have played, not only in that city's recovery, but obviously part of its history and its culture. Any questions or comments, you can join our conversation. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I was talking with our first guest from the Times-Picayune about all the reporters that came into New Orleans 10 years ago to cover the storm and then the aftermath. And I guess like any outsider, it takes a while to understand a city, and especially to understand a city in crisis. And he, you know, talked about the fact that in many ways they didn't really understand New Orleans. Was that your experience as well?
Well, it was my experience not just with the reporters, some of whom had come in from Iraq and cavalierly were referring to New Orleans as a wet Baghdad, speaking to their own condition of fear. There was a certain amount of gunslinging going on. It was never as bad as any others thought. I mean, I think the worst problem was that we had National Guards people before General Honoré arrived who were just completely clueless. And I mean, I had two guys, 19-year-old, pointing at an M16s at me, and when I'm carrying a stroller on my car, like I'm eluding a baby stroller. I mean, they were just so clueless. And then when I finally convinced them in my college professor lingo, talking to students, look, guys, you don't steal Dr. Seuss books and baby strollers. You know, I finally, you know, they apologized and they said, well, how do we get to so-and-so? They were, are those who were there to help the city were lost. Most of the people were gone. You know, we were out on exile and all the occupiers did not know where they were. And it was a big problem for a long time, a little by little. Of course, we got back and that improved. And let me say a shout out to Penn on this regard.
Sure.
Penn actually sent quite a few students down and collaborated with the University of New Orleans on some leadership programs, did a lot of work in St. Bernard Parish, which you hear less about, where the floodwaters reached 18 feet and, you know, parts outside the ring levees, and where the population still is very, very low in the return, on like the low 30%. And did a great deal. On the other side of the ledger, I came up to Penn. I made a tour of a lot of schools to talk about what had happened. And we were at a conference with the School of Design and the Wharton School and others. And, you know, people did – I had brought with me Eddie Bowe, one of the great New Orleans R&B players, who had actually used to be popular in Philly for his songs like Check Your Bucket and Mr. Popeye and all this stuff. And I also brought Earl Barthay. These are two building tradesmen, both Creoles, both involved in music. And my point was that unless we take care of culture, nothing else will really matter. And I'll tell you honestly, and these are academics from the outside and not just Penn people, there was scoffing in the room by urban planners about really the role of the intangible in music. And finally, then on the other side, you had historic preservationists saying, oh, we must rebuild it just perfectly. And a couple of the building trades guys just spoke up and said, you know, we don't need to build or rebuild historic buildings. What we need to do is create solid housing for people, however it's designed. And I thought they just spoke from the streets with enormous authority. And they kind of silenced the room of the experts and academicians in that moment. And, of course, playing some music helped to calm all the spirits in the room at the time.
Well, we're going
to
play some music to take us out of the hour. Nick Spitzer, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for all your good work and for taking care of New Orleans from Philadelphia.
Absolutely. Nick Spitzer, again, producer, host of APM's American Roots. And we do want to close things out with the Soul Rebels Brass Band. And this is No Place Like Home, marking, of course, the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, as Nick has reminded us, of course, the role of music and culture in recovery.
Oh,
talking about the high.
What's
rise
up? What's up? What's up? What's up with your boy? What's good with you?
Boom.
Look, Soul Rebels right here.
Right here.
We got Trombone Shorty coming down, lay some love on the joint for us.
You know it.
What he? Oh, I don't know what he playing. You know, whatever that boy walking the door with.
You know, walking in with a harmonica or something.
Let him get it how he live, man. Whatever he coming the door with, that's what he playing. I appreciate that right there. But Red, I want to take this time out to talk to you about my people, talk to you about New Orleans. Ain't no place like home in the world to me. I'm born and right here and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana. What you know about that?
I know all about that.
Let me talk to you about the culture, the art, the people right here.
Well, I know. Maybe you might even teach some other people. So
let me talk to them. Because my people, you can't get people like this nowhere else in the world. You know what I'm saying? Let me talk to you about that old school Treme Parade.
What?
That Zulu.
What?
That Endymion.
What?
That Vacas. Just tell me what you know about that.
That's all about
that. Where can you get that? Where can you get that anywhere else in the world?
Nowhere. You can't get that nowhere but here.
You know what I'm saying?
Nowhere but here.
Nowhere else but here. I'm talking about the flavor. The flavor is the culture, and the culture is the music. I'm talking about Uptown Magazine, Thursday night house party. Different races getting together in one place to hear the beat and the horns of the Soul Rebels Brass Band. Cause that's New Orleans, baby!